The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
Welcome, everyone. Most of us don't remember the first few years of our life. We are usually born with such innocence. We perhaps lived first few years without so much the ego, as well as also this thinking mind. It sounds like that we have been playing hooky for quite a while, in these first 2 years. We are very instinctual at an early age. When we are hungry, we cry. When we are happy, then we smile. As time goes by, we all started developing the ego structure along with the thinking mind, and then we began to have a sense of a self and become more aware of the separation between ourselves and the world around, as well as also this ever unfolding complex relationship between oneself and the outer world. And we begin to perceive that. And there are people, conditions, which can be a little bit detrimental to our existence. And there are also an environment, individuals and circumstances that can be benevolent to our existence. Out of that, we also developed a very strong sense of aversion, attachment, love, and hatred. Everybody goes through this psychological development. And then, as times go by, we become more and more individuated. And we develop a very strong sense of not only self, but also our own individual identity. And then we also have our own strengths as well as our own neuroses too. And then, just a matter of time, we all suffer sometime in our life. Suffering is not bad than just part of our existence, it's human existence. And there is this theory in Buddhist cosmology that there are many galaxy systems. These galaxy systems are known as the loka. The Buddhist cosmology calls our world, the 3,000-fold universe, Also, this world, this human world where we are living in, is known as the world of courageous ones. The idea is that this human world has more suffering than anywhere else in the entire universe. And people who choose to be in this world are extremely courageous. That's why they call this world as the world of courageous ones. Buddhism also teaches that this is one of those very few places in the universe that we can become enlightened. That's the good news. I favor the good news. Told you the bad news. The bad news is this is the world of suffering. We all suffer. If we have a moment to just sit and to really open our heart, we may share our own personal story. We are able to share our trauma, our anxiety, our fear, our insecurity. Sometimes people even have to be in solitude for a very long time to soften their heart, become vulnerable, and being able to be in touch with their own soul. Even Buddha said that the way to the freedom is by developing the acute awareness of your own self. It seems this is pretty much the first step on the journey to great awakening. Developing awareness of your own self. I grew up in Tibet. I was a renunciate for a very long time. I spent a lot of time doing the traditional Buddhist practice, memorizing scriptures, doing lots of Buddhist practices, which was wonderful. And then, I also remember I didn't have the chance in the monastery to share my own suffering. As time goes by, I kept my suffering to myself. I went in all these wonderful Buddhist practices, getting up early in the morning, reciting prayers, doing meditation, which are all good. I had to come to California to share my suffering with people. And somehow culture the I mean, this is true everywhere in the West. Many people are not afraid of sharing their suffering with each other in the West Coast. I've been spending a lot of time in the West Coast. And to me, when I felt comfortable share my own suffering with the people, that was the most liberating epiphany I ever had. As a matter of fact, there was a whole new level of understanding shift in my spiritual practice. Until that, I didn't know exactly I am suffering. Suffering is very deep in each of us. If we inquire at the very root of suffering, it's extremely complex. It has to do with the many causes and conditions. It has to do with the family we are born into, the culture we are born into, the country where we were raised. There's no single factor for our own suffering. As I said earlier, suffering is not something we should be aware of. We should recognize that it's really part of being human. Even learning to see the meaning, the purpose in human suffering. This brings about the idea of a path, the spiritual path. How many you feel that walk in the spiritual path? If you feel comfortable, please raise your hand. Quite a few people raised their hands, and some people are maybe a little bit quiet. Glad to see so many of you have raised your hand. When you enter the spiritual path, whatever that means, and then you realize that the suffering is not actually meaningless. You realize that suffering is a blessing in disguise. You realize that you can embrace human suffering to find your inner life and to also develop compassion, love, courage. And also you can learn through your own suffering how to expand your heart towards other human beings, as well as towards all living sentient beings. And in the end, through suffering, maybe you are able to discover even unconditional happiness and freedom, or maybe you are able to discover notions like your true nature, your original self, or dharma kaya, for the great emptiness. Or nibbana. At the same time, there's one powerful condition that caused so much suffering in all of us. And that is attachment. This must be some kind of big synchronicity because of some people asking me, if you synthesize the entire Buddhist teaching into one phrase, what would you say? And then just 2 days during lunchtime, I also heard that somebody asked a Buddhist teacher, what would you say in a simple verse if you synthesize the entire Buddhist teaching? Usually I always say the Arahant chapter, not the chapter. That's really what Buddhism is all about. Sometimes I spend lots of time around the Buddhist practitioners and also masters. We have a lot of discussion about what Buddhism is. Of course, if you focus on the outer form of Buddhism, then there are all kinds of Buddhism. Whereas when you look into the essence of all the Buddhist traditions, then it all comes down to the single practice. Non-attachment. Attachment is a source of lots of suffering. We can be attached to a lot of things in this life. We can be attached to material things. We can be attached to lots of ideas. Our own fantasies, we can be attached to emotions like resentment, anger, insecurity. Some Buddhist traditions emphasize quite a lot, dropping attachment towards the things from outside, like the material possession. Nice houses, cars, your career, your relationship. And then some Buddhist traditions emphasize more the idea of letting go of attachment towards things like your concepts, beliefs, and your thoughts, towards your mind and towards your emotions. So I have been practicing both of them. I told you I was renunciate for a long time, for many, many years, as a Sharamanaka. Sharamanaka keeps 53 precepts in Tibetan Buddhism. It's all about renouncing attachment towards external things. According to the traditional precepts, you're not supposed to touch anyone. Especially bhikkhus are not allowed to touch any money or gold. You're not supposed to have big houses. You're not supposed to have a bank account. And then, once I become a householder, and then I try to let go of attachment for the outer position. try to simplify life, which doesn't work very well these days. In this modern world, you need a car, and then you have a car, you have to put the gas, and you need the cell phone too, because now you need the GPS. And you have all these bills. Of course, you don't have to live a very luxurious life. You don't have to have attachment, money, and kind of hedonistic lifestyle, but just to survive in 21st century requires so much time, effort, so much even resources too. You know, sometimes I look at my clothes. One time I went to Tibet and I decided to buy a very sturdy boot. I went to this store and bought a boot. It cost quite a lot of money. I wore that in Tibet, and periodically I look at that boot and realize that if you spend the price of that boot in India, you can feed the whole village in India for maybe a few days. So sometimes you can feel a little bit guilty about it. In these days, my practice of non-attachment is more internal. One time, this mother brought a teenager boy to talk to me. And he said, "I want to practice Buddhism, but do I have to shave my head? Do I have to go to monastery?" I said, "Not yet. You don't have to do any of them." So this is what non-attachment is. I just want to make sure that this word non-attachment is not scaring you away. Some people are afraid of this word non-attachment. Because non-attachment is very different from detachment. And this is what meditation is. It is an art of cultivating non-attachment to your mind, to your thoughts, to your emotions. This is what mindfulness meditation is. Luckily, you have this beautiful meditation center where you can come here and learn how to practice the mindfulness meditation. This is also my practice to meditate mindfulness. I don't call it all the time, especially around my Tibetan colleagues. We use a different terminologies. When I tell my Tibetan Buddhist friends I'm practicing mindfulness, they think I'm now being converted into Theravada Buddhism. In the end, that's all there is. You can say the mindfulness is actually the highest Buddhist practice. It's the highest. And it is the innermost Buddhist practice. This is what the Buddha practice. I'm sure there are different levels of mindfulness meditation. How many of you practice mindfulness? Please raise your hand. You're already on the spiritual path. Most people raise their hand now. I will tell you are already on the spiritual path since you are already practicing mindfulness. So, I don't really have to teach a lot on mindfulness since we have many wonderful meditation teachers here. Perhaps you have heard very profound, inspiring teaching on mindfulness. It is about turning your attention inward. A Tibetan master said, meditation is like turning your eyeballs inward. This is a very clear description of what meditation is. This sounds so simple. On one hand, the turning our attention inward, and yet this is a very powerful act to do. This is what is missing in the world. We don't have the opportunity to look inward. There are around 7 billion people right now on this planet. I wonder how many people take even a few minutes every day to pause and look into their mind. Some people talk about it become enlightened or become awakened. I talk more about it become conscious. What we need is a conscious world. Conscious thought, conscious memory, conscious Buddhist. Because we can be Buddhist and totally be unconscious. Just a few days ago, I met with a Tibetan Lama who is very influential. He is maybe one of the most influential lamas in Tibet right now, a Buddhist teacher. He was given talk to the Buddhist community, mainly people from Asia. And there were a lot of Tibetans as well as of other Asians. And he said in front of all of them, which was quite shocking as well as radical. He said, going to temple, burning incense in front of Buddha is totally futile. His statement shocked everybody right there. So what he's trying to say is that we can be Buddhist, but totally be unconscious. And be just lost in our neuroses, in our delusion, lost in suffering, hatred, just like anybody else. So what we really need is not so much enlightened the society, because we even don't know what it means to be enlightened. And sometimes people don't agree on the definition of what means to be enlightened. And even the idea of awakening is sometimes little bit of such a piece of it. But we all can relate to the idea of being conscious. When we become conscious in ourselves, then we can impact our family, then we can impact the community, then we can impact the rest of the society. Many of the words, violence, and also a lot of the unnecessary things come from the fact that there's so much unawareness in this world. And so many people are suffering from this unawareness by being unconscious. Unconscious means that we're lost in our mind. That we can no longer distinguish between our mind. Mind is projections and the directions. As well as that, we have no longer have a inside awareness about our mind, but we are totally ruled by our mind, ruled by our thoughts and emotions, no matter how destructive, how invalid we are. When we take time and simply to turn our attention inward and we see what is happening in our and that inside alone is a life-changing process. Can you believe it? Just looking into your mind alone is life-changing process. Sometimes this is all we need. Just take some time looking into our own mind and see what is happening. What am I doing? And then maybe you can find a lot of suffering. You may find lots of neuroses, delusion. You may find there's a whole sea of things you should absolutely find. Recently, one time cartoon, this old man was lying on the bed at a hospital. He had just the brain surgery. The doctor brought a little monkey in front of him, said, "We just found this in your brain." As you know, there is an expression in Buddhism, the monkey mind. And there are all these stages of awakening in Buddhism. Eventually, many people say they become enlightened, or they discover the emptiness, but first thing you're going to discover is not the emptiness, it's the monkey mind. I always tell my friend, the way you can judge whether you're on the right path or not is if you're not finding enlightenment, good news. If you don't feel that, you're awakened to emptiness, that's very good news. If you don't have any divine vision, that's even better news. But if you discover the monkey mind, that's great news. You're on the right path. Of course, the monkey mind is more than just busy mind. It's just a symbol or metaphor to describe this unconscious, this conditioned human mind carrying so much pain, sorrow, judgment, fear, pride, anger, and not only that, when we are lost in this conditioned mind, okay? And then this conditioned mind becomes a veil obscuring the true nature of who we are and true nature of everything else. I would like to speak a little bit my own spiritual practice and hope that would make more sense, because I can go back and quote the Buddha and Buddhist masters and also to talk about certain profound topics. Somehow feels much more meaningful to share my own spiritual practice. When I start to practice meditation, that's what I discovered amongst myself. At that time, I wasn't very happy about it, but now I'm so happy that the first thing I discovered was a monkey mind rather than the Buddha mind, the original face, the great emptiness, and all this holy divine wisdom. And it was very painful to discover my own mind, because my mind wasn't always very beautiful, sometimes very messy. I didn't know that there's beauty and there's ugliness in my mind until I started meditating. And then, of course, the Buddhist teachings always say, don't judge whatever you discover. Just keep observing and looking at it. Loving and all-embracing attitude. With a non-judging, non-rejecting attitude. And then, it must be natural process that you have eventually impulse to transcend your mind. You know, once you keep looking, once you keep looking at your mind, you see all this messiness. Of course, there is sometimes a beauty in my mind, like love, compassion, joy. And then there are other times, always the messiness, like neuroses, that's right, anger and insecurity. I was saying that the natural impulse happens. You want to transcend it. You want to transcend your mind once and forever, because then you can tell yourself, then you're going to be happy eternally once you transcend your mind. Sounds very good strategy, doesn't it? And I worked so hard trying to transcend my mind for years. I tried using mantras, I tried using Tibetan Buddhist sadhana, actually read some Zen books, even though I didn't have a Zen teacher. I said, maybe Zen guys have some secret that we Tibetans don't have. And I can try to come up with a new koan for myself without really Zen master and trying to use some koans. With the desire to transcend my mind, because I didn't want to have my mind, which is understandable, isn't it? And I prayed to sometimes the Buddha to transcend my mind, but there wasn't any reply. And I tried all kinds of techniques, literally, with the single desire to transcend my mind. But then when you look carefully, the whole idea of transcending mind is really nothing more than your desire to get rid of your mind. But the truth is that we cannot transcend our mind. This is my discovery. You cannot transcend your mind. And when I tell this to people, some people like and some people can't believe it. They think, oh, I'm going to transcend my mind. He just failed. And that's why the word transcendence is so tricky. I hardly use the word transcendence. I don't know how many of you have hearing my teaching. If you heard my teaching 10 years ago, almost in every lecture I give, there's at least few words transcendence used. And I hardly use even the word transcendence. And to me, Nirvana is not really transcendent. Enlightenment is not transcendent. So maybe you wonder, what are you doing now since you failed at transcendence? It sounds really a very bad situation. You kind of stuck. You discovered the monkey mind. You couldn't transcend. Sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? And now my practice is really simple. I would tell you, this sounds so simple, you would not believe how simple it is. You think, oh, now he has some profound secret to share. Not at all. I know my mind better. This is all I know. I know how my mind works. My mind is very smart, smarter than me. And my mind has lots of strategies. It's a brilliant. Unbelievably brilliant. But usually it comes with so many strategies to make itself more unconscious. Does this make sense? It has all kinds of tricks, games, intelligent tactics to remain unconscious. And that's all I need to do. That's all you need to do. Know your mind. Know your mind as limitation. Know your games. Know your neuroses. We all have neuroses. We should have sometimes a neurosis party. And go around. This is my neurosis. Show me your neuroses. Eat delicious pie. Put the music on. The party celebrating the neuroses. Like sometimes people go outside and show their costumes, we can show our neuroses to each other. So once you know your all neuroses, actually this is the purpose of Buddhist practice. I've been practicing Buddhism for a long time, and there's no end of this journey. And it's just a ever unfolding, sometimes exhausting, sometimes rewarding journey to keep discovering your own neuroses. And the more you discover your neuroses, the subtler it becomes. Does this make sense? And Kabir talked about it. Kabir, great Indian poet. I do not recall his poem word by word, but he said, first I become renunciate, he said. I get rid of fancy clothes and start wearing the mendicant's robe. And then I realized that I was wearing it so elegantly to impress others. And then I gave in that. And then I discovered I was so frustrated by desire. Then I worked so hard to transcend desire, finally I did it. And then one day I discovered that I'm so angry. So I worked very hard to transcend anger, which I did. And now I'm proud of myself. So you see it. So many people think that the spiritual path has an end, but it has no end. It's a lifelong journey. I don't think there's a such thing that somebody becomes enlightened. Of course, I'm not referring to Buddha. Maybe he was fully enlightened. But other than that, I just don't see that somebody can be enlightened. I start really doubting this whole idea of that somebody you can be enlightened. And personally, I don't like to be enlightened. Do you like to be enlightened? Don't you think it's some kind of ego game, this idea that you can be enlightened someday? I don't think we need to be enlightened. We just have to walk in the spiritual path, rest of our life. Because in my experience, the more you practice Buddhism, the more you discover your neurosis. The more you discover your neurosis, subtler they become. It's like the years there. So it's not like there's going to one day that you are totally enlightened, no more neuroses, you are a pure being suddenly. This turned out to be a great myth. And this myth can be misleading sometimes. And there are people who claim that they are enlightened and turned out to be a quite actually disastrous statement. So I know my mind, I'm still learning my mind. So sometimes my neuroses arise. Even in everyday life, my thoughts, I have sometimes anger, sometimes insecurity, they arise. And at the same time, there are no truth in them. They're totally invalid. Once I know them, my secret, I'm going to share with you. This is not a profound secret. It's a very simple secret. I use this method. Leave them alone. Don't pick them up. When they arise, you know they are there. You know that they are part of your mind. You know that they are deep-seated habits. You know them. Don't follow them. Don't do anything with them. Sometimes you may have to view them just stuff on the ground, on the road. Don't pick them up. Just don't pick up your thoughts. Don't pick up your mind. Let them arise and let them dissolve on their own. So I would like to invite everybody to pick up one thought or emotion that has been dominating your life, and that is causing you pain right now, this time in your life. Let's close our eyes for a few seconds. Choose one single thought, one particular thought, a particular emotion that seems to be almost stuck in your psyche as almost a stone. And you don't know what to do with it. You don't like to have it, but so powerful. It feels more powerful than your personal will. Try to pick one of them and name it. Let me first see how destructive this thought, this emotional pattern is. You know, it caused so much pain to you, and also it may cause so much pain to people around you, and you know that deep down, if you live with this habit, this mental habit, there's going to be continuation of the pain, suffering. Thank you for your reflection. Next time when this thought, emotion arises, please be very vigilant. And remember this very simple method, which is leave it alone. Don't follow it. Don't pick it up. Just leave it alone. And right there, there's already freedom. And then you don't have to transcend anything. And this is the practice. This is a very powerful spiritual practice that you can do on the cushion, and you can do this anywhere in the car as well. And eventually our habits die. We have all these mental habits which are not a permanent state of our consciousness. All our mental habits are not even self-sustained. They die on their own unless we keep feeding them. The moment we have this very simple recognition, and then we are no longer feeding our habits, our mental habits, our psychological habits. As time goes by, they begin to die, one after the other. And then we begin to feel that there's more joy, more love, more compassion, more peace in our life. And which has nothing to do with what is happening in the outer world, but it has to do with the state of your own consciousness. Let me end this talk by reciting a beautiful phrase from great Chan Master Women's poem. If your mind is not clouded with unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. This is what we can be awakened. Much gratitude, and now I will invite all of you to sing a mantra. This is a Mahayana Buddhist mantra. It goes, Om Gati Ngati, Parangati, Parasamgati, Bodhi Swaha. It means gone, gone beyond, completely what awakened. We'll sing this mantra together. Is everybody open to it? Swaha. thank everybody for coming here tonight.
The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.